Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there. You're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and in each episode, I interview professors, doctors, and research scientists who are leading authorities in technology, economics, business, politics, the environment, and sociology, so we can learn about the scientific breakthroughs that will redefine our world. Today, I'm delighted to share with you my conversation with Professor Yannis Ioannou. Professor Ioannou is one of the world's leading experts on sustainability, corporate social responsibility, and he's the Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at London Business School. We discussed the need for sustainability and corporate social responsibility to be central to the strategies of organizations. One of the really interesting parts of the conversation was where he described the fall of Kodak, the fall of Blockbuster, and other companies like them that didn't react to the exponential changes in technology as analogous to things that might happen with those organizations that don't take sustainability and corporate social responsibility seriously. It was a really fascinating and interesting discussion. I probed into why he thought that and what organizations and business leaders needed to do about it. It's a truly fascinating conversation. He's a really engaging speaker, so I think you're going to enjoy this. And now I'll hand you over to Professor Yannis Ioannou. Professor Ioannou, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Can we start with your research interests? It'd be great to get an introduction to you and what you focus your time researching. So could you just give a flavor of the work that you currently do?
Yes, absolutely. So I've been at the London Business School for about 15 years now. And all of my work, all of my research is to try to understand how is it that companies integrate environmental and social issues into the way they do business. So my background is in economics and strategy. So my interest here is really trying to understand how is it that companies try at least to navigate all these pressures, all these challenges, and essentially the complexity that we have seen in recent years that derives precisely from the world's environmental and social challenges worsening. So you can think about issues like climate change, the loss of biodiversity, demands for the inclusion, diversity, belonging, and all those issues in the environmental and social domain. And I think from a strategy point of view, this is particularly interesting because truth of the matter is that, you know, if you take the last 50 or 60 years, these are issues that were broadly neglected. So companies have particular difficulty, inertia, and gaps, essentially, whether it's capabilities gaps or human capital gaps that do not allow them to easily navigate these challenges. So my personal interest is trying to understand how is it that they're doing this. And also more specifically, I'm also interested at the I'm studying the intersection of companies and financial markets, because it's one thing to see these challenges from an inside out perspective, how companies themselves are trying to adjust. But also, I think it's equally interesting in terms of how is to adopt the outside in perspective and see how financial markets more specifically are rewarding, punishing, assessing, evaluating this corporate effort to really bring these environmental and social issues at the core of this sort of perhaps new model or emerging new model of doing business.
Thank you. So I think the core concepts, I know there are many concepts that you're focused on, but the core ones that everyday people would be familiar with are sustainability and corporate social responsibility. So could you help us by framing the conversation by just defining very simply in everyday language what they mean?
Yes, absolutely. So this is a problem with this space, as you know, Ian, in the sense that we have way too many terms and concepts on the table. And you mentioned a number of them. And as you know, there's even more. So for me, I think it's I don't have one definition that I use, but rather I use this sort of three-level approach so that people are understanding what we are talking about. So there is first the conceptual level. In other words, that's the basic real fact that the world in general and business more specifically are facing a whole host of environmental and social issues. Often enough, these issues are interdependent, right? So in other words, there is the concept based on the, well, basic reality that these challenges exist, right? So that's what you might call sustainability or environmental and social issues, but this is the reality. The second level is that these are not static challenges. They evolve very quickly, right? So especially if you think about environmental issues, you just think about how climate science has evolved in recent years, how our understanding of diversity, biodiversity has evolved in recent years, how we came to understand more about the plastics pollution and so on and so forth. Same happens with social challenges. If you think about issues like diversity, inclusion, belonging, gender pay gap, and so on, these are evolving challenges that, you know, perhaps 20, 30 years ago, we as a society, we did not care as much collectively, but we now do. So the second layer that we need to keep in mind as we try to define what it is that we're talking about is that it's a little bit of a moving target, precisely because the science as well as the sociological processes are developing. And therefore, the third layer is essentially what we're talking about, which is the labeling. And the labeling has shifted over the years, obviously starting with this idea of corporate social responsibility that is perhaps closer today to philanthropy. Then we have progressed to talking about corporate citizenship. We have the emergence of the term ESG, which essentially started as a label that captures the data, right? It's essentially the label for a data set that tries to capture how we measure environmental and social issues for companies. And what drives the labeling could be many factors. Clearly, the labeling is related to the underlying environmental and social challenges and how they evolve, but there's many other factors here. So think about it, you know, from a if we're talking about how the label is being used in the world of consulting, then that might be driven by, you know, the consulting services that they are selling. If we talk about the world of academia, you know, that's a more sort of a more stable labeling that has been maintained over time. We started with CSR, now we're talking about sustainability. But the most important factor, and perhaps very relevant to recent years, is that labels are also inherently political, right? So that's why we talk in the US right now about the anti-ESG backlash. That's why some people want to try to frame ESG as within the broader woke and wokeness that we have seen in the US and trying to come to the UK. But that's the labeling level. And I think when a lot of people discuss this idea of labeling, right, they focus on the labeling level that I just described. But that's only the third level. I think what is much more important for me, what I'm much more interested in understanding, is first of all, the reality, right, of environmental and social issues that we face. And second of all, their evolution. Now, whatever label you want to choose to bring them into the domain of business is fine by me, as long as you are fully understanding in reality, right, what it is that we're talking about and how those environmental issues essentially evolve because of science and because of sociological processes. It's a little bit of a longer answer because it's all good and fine to have a definition, but I'm much more typically, and in my work as well, I'm much more interested in what is the underlying substance of these issues? And in fact, what are the processes that may be driving these different labels that we put on these issues?
That's very clear. So that leads perfectly on to the kind of theme that I'd like to discuss for the next 5 or 10 minutes. Which is the connection between corporate strategy and focusing or incorporating the ideas of sustainability and corporate social responsibility and biodiversity and all the things that you just talked about. But with the goal of a corporate executive, which is largely to increase shareholder value, and the contradiction in the, or not, between the two. And I thought what was very interesting, I was doing some research earlier last week, And it was by an American think tank that showed that over 80% of the compensation received by chief executives in listed companies in America was a direct result of their share options and their share awards, and therefore the increase in the share price, and therefore the increase in shareholder value. So this connection, I think, is very, very important, because it's a question in my mind as to whether or not the goal of shareholder value and the goal of sustainability are complementary or not. So a long question, but I think it's quite a broad topic that we could discuss. How would you go about thinking about that connection and thinking about the possible conflicts within them?
Absolutely. So I'll give you a little bit of a nuanced answer, because I think this is, in fact, the core of the issue and something that is often discussed, and we really need to go deep and understand it. So first of all, from a business point of view, what is this sort of demand for more sustainability or demands for more responsibility? And as I often say, what we need to keep in mind first and foremost is that within this label of sustainability, there is two co-evolving stories. And the first one, and I think this is the one that people avoid talking about because perhaps it's the more difficult one. The first story within sustainability is what I call the "it's time to pay the bill" story. Right? In other words, if you look at the abuse and overexploitation of resources, of people within supply chains and so on, what you realize is that the world is waking up and is discovering these negative impacts. And at least to some extent, we're saying this has to stop, or at least we need to pay the cost. That's why, for instance, we're talking about the carbon tax. That's why we're talking about more regulations in terms of supply chains, no child labor, right? No modern slavery and all those things, which basically tells me, right? And I think that's why a lot of the times you find there is resistance and say, oh, my costs are going to go up if I'm going to become more responsible or sustainable. But what you need to understand as a business is that you're not entitled to that artificially low cost if you're imposing what we would call in economics terms these negative externalities to society at large and to the environment. So the tough part in that sense of the sustainability story is realizing that the costs are going to go up. And it's not a trade-off per se. It's the reality of the cost you're really imposing on society and the environment. Just because, you know, the market mechanism did not have a good enough way in the past to price in those externalities, it doesn't mean A, that they don't have a price, and B, that they're not negative externalities. So for companies to really sort of, as they start thinking about this so-called trade-off, they need to understand that the world is demanding that the costs reflect the reality. Right. So the best of companies are the ones that say, okay, if that is true, then what investments do I need to make today so I am actually prepared for a world in which these externalities is priced in? And we see this shift, right? I mean, think about according to several estimates, the trillions of dollars that were and euros that were currently subsidizing fossil fuels. I mean, talking about artificially low costs, right? So we need to imagine a world where those subsidies are not there, or better still, they go into renewables, right? So that story is very important to get, because a lot of people get stuck, not, you know, almost in denial. And of course, if you think that you are entitled to those lower costs and not paying the real externality, then of course you will see the trade-off, right? Now, that's half of the sustainability story. And there's also the opportunity side. And we have seen this in the domain of renewables. We have seen this in electric vehicles. We are already seeing this in terms of alternative materials. And the opportunity side, people are realizing that when you have this shift in demands and expectations across all stakeholders, and more specifically customers and younger generations, then you start rethinking your business model, your products, and your services. Now, what happens in that second part of the story, in the opportunity, is that, again, trade-offs might manifest as inertia. In other words, think about all these incumbents, these large existing companies that have a particular way of currently doing business. chances are, right, if you want that a more sustainable way of doing business is going to be in conflict, at least in some respects, right, with what you're doing today. So that conflict will manifest itself again as a trade-off. Notice, and the important thing here is that type of trade-off exists for incumbents. If you are an entrant, if you are one of these companies that entered these new spaces, you don't face that type of a trade-off. So for instance, if you're Tesla, you've never produced a fossil fuel car. So what's the conflict you'll face with your previous business model, right? So when we talk about trade-offs and profitability, it's not just one thing. It manifests very differently depending on which side of the story you're talking about, the cost or the opportunity, and whether you are an incumbent or a startup in this space, which again, these trade-offs manifest differently. Now, within the opportunity, you know, strategy, as Michael Porter taught us, it's all about trade-offs. It's all about being unique. It's about choosing how to be unique by navigating this trade-off. So rather than looking at trade-offs as obstacles, right, quite the reverse. It's they're opportunities if you treat them right. So that's kind of the foundation of how I think about this. Now, when we come to profitability, therefore, against this background, we need to be aware that if you want to transition to a sustainable business model, you still need to have a strategy. In other words, if there was a recipe or an off-the-shelf way of doing this, well, everybody would do it, right? And we wouldn't even have a climate change problem today. The transition itself is challenging for companies. And why is it challenging? For two main reasons. First of all, across most industries, I would argue that companies do not have the necessary human capital in order to do this transition. I often talk about the example of insurance companies, right? Assume that you are an insurance company that it's actually having clients or insured assets in areas susceptible to flooding or wildfires or droughts and so on. Well, how could you possibly price the premiums correctly if you don't understand the impacts of climate change? Now, a lot of people think, oh, yeah, of course, I'm just going to subscribe to an ESG data set, get some carbon numbers, and I'll be able to do this. That's not true. I mean, even science has not yet found a way to translate climate change into specific impacts on assets, maybe regions of the world, but not assets. But you, as an insurance company, need to price at the asset level, right? So what do? Well, you think that the world's climate scientists are sending in their CVs to work for insurance companies these days, right? Most of them, I mean, some of them might, and some insurance companies are actually trying to hire climate scientists, and some of them have, but on average, it's very difficult to acquire that human capital, right? Now, think about even more complex issues. Think about biodiversity, for instance. Do you think that scientists that work in biodiversity are sending in their CVs to work for insurance companies? They're not. So what happens, though, look at Florida, right? You see insurance companies just packing up and leaving the market. And you end up with either legacy insurance policies, or you have people that if they want to insure their homes, they pay more on insurance premiums than they pay on their mortgage, right? So in addition to the human capital aspect, companies are in that kind of aggregates up, because if you don't have the human capital, that means you're unable to generate the necessary capabilities. And again, going back to your question, well, of course, if you look at your organization and you don't have the human capital and you don't have the capability to address a particular issue within sustainability, guess what? Of course, you're going to face trade-offs. In fact, not only trade-offs, you're also going to face what I would always call the sustainability issue, a major disruption, because you lack the skills, the knowledge, and the experience required to navigate this disruption. And it's not as easy as, oh, let's go digital or let's adopt AI. There's many AI experts that want to work for companies and build up their capability. But in the environmental and social domain, traditionally, business haven't engaged with those type of stakeholders or haven't engaged enough. And I'm talking, again, on average. That's exactly why we have all these problems today and all these challenges. So because sustainability is a disruption, what we need to be aware is that it's not, you know, transitioning to a sustainable business model is not just, oh, you know, I'm going to resolve these trade-offs or find a win-win and dance kumbaya with my stakeholders and everything will be good and fine in the world. It's a major business disruption. It's a shift in the competitive landscape. And what we know from, you know, previous disruptions that perhaps were not as huge as this one is that, you know, the corporate graveyard is packed with iconic brands that often failed to navigate these disruptions. Sears, Kodak, Polaroid, Blockbuster, the list is endless. So the challenge for executives, especially those that are in incumbent organizations, and as they try to create value, right, and therefore integrate these challenges and of course remain profitable businesses, is really to navigate that disruption. And the way to navigate that disruption is by adapting. Literally, it's an adaptation challenge to this shifting competitive landscape. So it's not, I mean, of course, as a person, you can have your own moral imperatives about why you want to do this and why you want your business to engage on this issue. But fundamentally, in my view, given how the world is changing, this is a challenge of adapting to a new competitive landscape. And it will come with the gaps, the trade-offs, and the inertia that we talked about earlier. And that's where ultimately managerial discretion and capability shines through, or some cases doesn't, but that's where it comes in.
So I'm really interested in the examples that you use when you were referring to the corporate graveyard. So we talked about Kodak, and they were disrupted by the digitization of photography, even though they invented the technology themselves and chose not to disrupt themselves. We have Blockbuster affected by digitization of film watching, and you know, Netflix and the others have disrupted them significantly. And Sears arguably were disrupted by e-commerce. They didn't embrace it in the way that they needed to, and Amazon and others like it took their business away. But they were technological disruptions. Whereas this is different to that. This is about sustainability. This is about the environment. This is about doing the right thing and business ethics. So what would be really interesting to understand is what would be the circumstances that an organization could be substantially disrupted in the way that Kodak, Sears, and Blockbuster were, but rather than as a technological innovation, they were disrupted by this sustainability or this ethics agenda that you're talking about.
Right. So I think there's at least three ways that I can think of, and probably there are more. So first of all, I wouldn't draw a sharp distinction between, for instance, technology and sustainability. In fact, we know that sustainability has propelled us to come up with new technologies. Think about, for instance, electric vehicles and the explosion in battery technology, for instance. Think about renewables and the explosion in technologies like how to supply solar panels and wind farms and so on and so forth. So I think that the technology aspect is still there. And that's part of the gap that I talked about earlier, in the sense that many companies are not used to that type of innovation, technological innovation, that in addition to having the quality aspect, it also has this environmental and social aspect. In my view, and I think this is something that we still need to study and understand better, there is a substantive difference between, let's call it, our regular innovation and innovation that is geared towards more sustainable business models or products and services. Think about this, for example, in the context of the circular economy, right? A lot of the underlying innovation in terms of how you build a circular business model is technological innovation. You are rethinking the design of the products. You are rethinking your production methods. You are rethinking the materials that you use. You are closing the loop. So now you have to be able to disassemble some of these, disassemble the materials that you use for your products and be able to reuse them in a new product generation. So a lot of the sustainability innovation is underpinned actually by innovations in technology and the production of new knowledge. So that is one reason why companies may experience this as a disruption, because they don't have or they haven't yet developed the capabilities required in the technological innovation space and production of new knowledge within the context of sustainability. The other dimension is, of course, the customer dimension. And we have seen that in some industries. So for instance, think about this. Think about Oatly or in general, alternative milk products. Again, we're still in early days, but imagine that you're a traditional cooperative that has cows and produces natural milk. And suddenly you see Oatly coming on the horizon. A lot of people are shifting towards these alternative types of milk, right? How do you compete with that? Yeah, of course, you're going to experience that as a disruption. You have cows. What capabilities are transferable in a world where more and more people are drinking Oatly rather than oat milk, essentially, or almond milk or any other type of alternative milk as opposed to natural milk? And then you look at California, for instance, and there is coffee chains that already said, you know what? Most of our clients are asking for oat milk. So why should it be the case that natural milk should be the default? Because right now, you know, you go and say, oh, I want a latte with oat milk. But they say, well, if everyone wants oat milk, then, you know, we'll make that the default. And if you want a latte with natural milk, you have to ask for it. So when you are faced with those kinds of customer changes, you can experience this as a disruption, especially when you're not facing the same underlying capability. You don't have the underlying capability to compete. And this applies not just to alternative milk. Think about the entire shift into healthier diets. And we have seen this with Impossible Food, Beyond Meat, and so on. So alternatives to meat, which we know is a huge contributor to carbon emissions, right? So if that's a whole different set of capabilities and, in fact, technologies to produce alternative meats, to produce plant-based diet, or even to produce lab-grown alternatives compared to what we had before, to natural milk and regular meat, I guess. And the third component, as another example, is the fact that this disruption results from the fact that it is not clear to me, and it varies across industries, but it's not clear to me which core capabilities and competencies of the old world transfer into the new world. And when the two are in conflict, it might well be detrimental. For instance, think about European utilities. A number of them tried under the same roof, right, to do electricity production based on fossil fuels while at the same time using renewables. And they realized like this is so impossible to do this that they had to literally break down the business, right? Restructure and have a standalone business that is producing based on fossil fuels and another one for renewables because that capability a clash was too strong. It was difficult for investors to really value these companies. Like, what exactly are you doing? At what rate are you transitioning? And ultimately, the idea here is that, you know, I'm breaking this down into two businesses with the challenge then becomes how I will ultimately sunset the fossil fuel business in order to fully transition into renewables. So that conflict is experienced exactly because of these clashing capabilities, and that can also translate into clash in incentives and clash in organizational structures. And think about it. These are the standard challenges we know from strategy when a company is trying to compete with two business models. Because in the sustainability space, what you essentially see is that within this transition, the old business models are resisting hard. Right, and for corporates, that's a challenge because the old business models are resisting because they have been traditionally the cash cows of corporations, right? Especially when we talk about conglomerates. And these new business models, whether we talk about renewables or where we talk about plant-based diet and so on and so forth, are the new kid of the block. They're still small. They're still experimental. They do require resources, but in the long run, ultimately, they pose a threat to the traditional business. And the traditional business is, of course, going to fight tooth and nail in order to maintain itself. That's why there's also a big question mark when a lot of these oil and gas companies are talking about transitioning into renewables. Well, there's a big question mark in terms of, well, okay, but what capabilities are you going to transfer to this new world of renewables? Are they transferable? So they tell us, well, we have large project management capabilities, or we know how to drill offshore. So that might be useful if we're drilling for offshore wind farms. Well, yeah, but then again, you have other capabilities like, you know, oil transport port and oil refining that, well, in a world of renewables, don't have much use anyway. Right. So therefore, you have an incentive to kind of leverage those capabilities today and milk them from cash rather than transitioning. And that is exactly why, you know, we see at least some of the big oil majors spending more time on marketing for renewables than they spend on actual investment in renewables. Right. So trying to sort of greenwash their way of getting there. But that's not sustainable in the long run, because if the economics of renewables continues on the current trajectory, in other words, if renewables are becoming cheaper, then the basic business model comes under threat. So those are just, again, three broad domains and perhaps three broad examples on the technology front, on the customer front, and on the clashing between old and new business models, that three broad factors that for me are saying, you know, why this disruption is so big, and also why it's very likely that a number of these companies are going to fail during this transition process.
It's really interesting. It sounds like disruptive innovation, but just a different version of it. Is that a correct interpretation?
Oh, absolutely. And that is why, personally, I think that the strategy lens and everything we have traditionally learned from strategy is so important, because ultimately, if you're going to create value through sustainability, you need to have a strategy. And here is a strategy of adaptation and navigating this transition. But unlike previous perhaps transitions that we have seen, you do have this added complexity, the moving target, and the lack of underlying skills and capabilities, sometimes even the lack of basic understanding about the challenge that you're facing. And because these issues have become political in recent years, a number of companies either hide behind the politics or are in outright denial about the need to transition, and they rely on politics to either slow it down, or through their lobbying efforts, or sometimes outright corruption efforts, to delay this transition.
So I think the interesting thing here, and correct me if I'm wrong here, and I could well be, when we go back to the other examples that we talked about of Blockbuster and Kodak and so on, that they were disrupted as a result of what people call exponential technologies. So the rate of change was so significant that once they were behind the curve, they just did not have a chance of catching up. Now, here it feels different. It doesn't feel like the rate of change is exponential. And I think what comes then into this is around timing and what type of perspective you have in terms of short, medium, and long-term views. So if you're a CEO, or, you know, company running a big company, what you do on this agenda in the next 12 to 18 months, maybe even longer, is unlikely to affect the returns your shareholders get, I would guess. I'm guessing here. But if you take a 10-year view or a 20-year view, if you take the arguments that you're making, then it's going to be existential, potentially transformative in their industry. So given that, quite often, CEOs and their boards are focused on short-term results. They're rewarded through shareholder value over a shorter time period than this agenda would require. How do they, and actually addressing the problem is likely going to increase their costs and increase their investment requirements in the short term, at least during the transition. How do you balance all of these things?
Mm-hmm. So these are very, very important considerations. So let's unpack some of them. So you in your last comment, you mentioned this is both they will require cost as well as investments, right? And that's a crucial difference, because yes, the markets may react, they might react negatively to unnecessary costs but the markets do react positively to necessary investments. So the question is, you as a business, if you're undertaking those investments, can you convince your shareholders that those are the investments that are going to make the business more robust? And don't get me wrong, even if we call them broadly sustainability investments, they're both sustainability and investments. In other words, you should be able to make that case to your stakeholders about why are you investing. Forget about the sustainability context for a second. Let me give you an example. Let's say that, you know, especially these days, you're a pharmaceutical company. You see this explosion in medication for obesity, for instance, right? And we have seen this with Ozempic, Wegovy, and others. So as a pharmaceutical company, you go to your investors and say, look, I can see this trend. I'm going to invest $1 billion in projects that are for developing drugs for obesity. I mean, do you think any of your investors are going to say, no, don't do that? Of course, they see the huge market. They see the writing on the wall. They know that, you know, if you invest $1 billion today in R&D as a pharmaceutical, you're not going to get a blockbuster drug tomorrow or even this year or even in the next 12 months. It's going to take longer. But, you know, in other words, investors will, of course, invest for the long run, and investors do invest a lot in pharma companies. So in other words, if that argument about 12 to 18 month cycles was always true and for all investors, we wouldn't have a pharmaceutical industry today because it requires huge upfront investment. And let's be honest, you know, a lot of these kind of drug experiments fail until you get to the blockbuster. So I think making that blanket statement that even if that investors have 12 to 18 months and they see everything as a cost in terms of an investment is simply not true. And ultimately, you know, as my colleagues in finance say, you know, what is the stock price of a company today? Well, in principle, it should be the discounted value of all future cash flows. Well, how do you determine all those future cash flows? Almost that by definition, it's a long term measure. So in that respect, if you look at investors that look at the stock price today through that lens, then it would totally make sense to invest in a business that ultimately makes those investments in order to adapt to this shifting competitive landscape. So therefore, the second thing I want to push back a little bit here is that not all investors are the same. Not all investors have the same time frame. And if you look at massive amounts of capital in terms of institutional investors, in terms of pension funds, even in terms of passive investments more broadly, you'll see that they do have that long-term orientation. It's not only active daily trading that is driving the market. So because of all of those reasons, I mean, don't get me wrong, you will find very excessively short-term investors, you will find, you know, hedge funds and so on and so forth. But I would argue that the broader financial markets, they do see the writing on. I mean, after all, it's their job, right? It's their job to make investments with a long-term horizon, especially if you're a pension fund. How could you not? For instance, is your job as an asset owner, if you're a pension fund, to instruct your asset manager and say, look, I have a 30, 40 year horizon here. Think about family offices and family business and wealth management offices, right? Those, in addition to all their financial considerations, they look at legacy, they look at generational reputation, they look at preserving the capital for the family. Those also have a long-term horizon. So although, you know, there is this idea of discussing very, very short-term and pathologies, because of course you're going to find this excessive pathologies in markets, we shouldn't lose track of the fact that there is a bigger picture and there are a lot of reasonable investors that can understand it and do understand that this is a shift in the competitive landscape. Of course, there's inertia, right? You know, the markets are not fully structured the way that they should be for sustainability. As you know, we have a huge challenge with measuring consistently what is sustainability, how sustainable a company is. We are still in the early days of disclosure laws and regulations across the world that will force companies to tell us what they're doing on this issue so that investors can account for that information. But if you see the direction of travel, I think we're going at the right direction. And we are going at a reasonable speed, although ideally we want to go faster. And the last point I want to make is you mentioned that, you know, when we talk about technological innovations, these happen very quickly. It might not be the case when we talk about sustainability, but here's the difference. We have binding time constraints, and these are given to us by science. It might well be the case that, you know, you and I in the markets negotiate and say, well, this is a 10 or a 15-year horizon. But truth of the matter is that, you know, we are breaking record after record in terms of temperatures, global warming. We are running out of time. We should be, at this point in time, reducing our emissions by 8 to 9% a year. And instead, we're still increasing them by 2 to 3%. We have the binding sort of Paris Agreement to stay within 2 degrees and preferably at 1.5. And 2023 was the year in which average temperatures actually exceeded already 1.5. So not only this is not a 10 or 15 year horizon, if we go by the science, not even touching social issues yet, but if we go by the science of environmental issues, we are at not at T equals zero, but at T equals minus one. We are already too late in terms of addressing these issues. Whether people are understanding or not, or whether inertia is so high or the politics is so contested that some people are in denial is a different discussion. But if we do look at the reality of climate change and the reality of environmental issues, not only is there exponential growth, but we're already beyond the boundaries that would allow us, you know, to be in the safe zone. Especially for now, we have already broken through 1.5 at least on average in this year. And already 2024 is not looking particularly promising. So the short answer is that unlike previous disruptions and technological innovations, here we have a very binding, objective, scientific constraint that effectively we ignore at our own peril. There was no binding constraint in technological innovations. You could take your time to adjust. It could happen very quickly. But this is not the case when we talk about sustainability.
Do we see investors, the financial markets more broadly, rewarding companies that are making significant progress on this agenda yet?
It depends on, which investor it is that you're talking about. I think that similar to corporate responses, we've seen the whole range. We have seen those that have doubled down on ESG does not matter. And we have voices even in academia on that part of the spectrum, all the way to the other side of the spectrum, which people double down on impact, willing to compromise on returns and everything in between. So it depends on, you know, the asset class that you're talking about, the type of investor that you're talking about, and different investors, different asset classes are moving at different speeds. But here's the thing, Ian, that we need to keep in mind. There is no such thing as a 100% sustainable company. We have seen sort of glimmers of success under particular leaders in particular time periods, but we haven't seen yet a full-on transition. So what we need to keep in mind is that right now we are going through what I call the muddy middle. It is the period in which corporates themselves are running a whole series of experiments in order to figure out how to do this. And on the other side, we see a lot of investors from the outside trying to figure out what companies are doing and where is the safest way, or perhaps not the safest, but how to allocate capital like they used to by considering this additional information, right? So in other words, within the investor community, you'll still see the variation in time horizons. You will see some investors are going to take higher risk. So for instance, you know, you're going to have investors that still invest in startups and have switched to climate tech, understanding that those are high risk. You will see investors investing in carbon capture technologies that are also very high risk. You'll also see pension funds that are going to say, you know what, I need to invest in funds that you reduce the carbon exposure of my portfolio. So I think we've seen a whole range of reactions. I would say that, again, it's the trajectory. I think that on average, exactly because we talk so much about ESG, about data, and so on, I think investors get this on average and they respond to it in different ways. Don't get me wrong. We have seen a change of labels, right? I mean, think about Larry Fink. He started talking about ESG, then sustainability, then is kind of changing it now to decarbonization, like many asset managers do. That is a change in language. In my conversations with a lot of investors and asset management companies is that the substance of integrating these emerging risks is there. That's their job, right? That's their fiduciary duty to understand the risk and integrate it into their investment decisions. Now, whether they put the sustainability or the ESG label on it or not, depending on the politics of where they're located and the institution in which they function, again, that's a separate discussion. But I do think, at least from the risk perspective, on average, investors are getting it. But again, within the investors, also different investment strategies, right? The question is, well, do you have a growth strategy? Do you have an emerging market strategy? Do you have more of a high-risk strategy of investing in startups? There's the private equity model. There's the hedge fund model. So sustainability and ESG has quite literally penetrated all of those. And also different asset classes, whether we talk about equities or whether we talk about, for instance, fixed income and bonds and credit ratings. Again, we have investors looking at that, and notice that sometimes it is structural inertia that might prevent a more obvious transition. And let me give you an example: a massive amount of the world's investments are in passive funds, right? Not active funds, and also. Within passive funds, we have a number of ETFs. And a lot of these ETFs are old. You have 20, 30-year-old ETFs. Well, even if they want to integrate sustainability and ESG into the investment process, well, it's structurally difficult to go back and change the investment mandate of a 20-plus-year-old ETF. So the legal structure, or at least the legal process, ought to change in order to see that we see that integration. And I think that's going to happen as well. But there's different reasons why perhaps, one could argue that in the financial market side, the transition might be relatively slower, might look as if it's going, two steps backward, one step forward, and so on and so forth. But on average, I think we are on the right path, although that path will ultimately need to be accelerated.
So this is a very complicated agenda. What advice would you give to a business leader, someone that's running a company, someone that's the board of a company, of how they should approach all of the issues that we've talked about on this conversation so far?
It's a great question, Ian. And I think that there's several things that business leaders and especially senior executives ought to do. First of all, well, build that human capital and that capability that we talked about earlier. Cover that gap. Whether it is at the board level, bring in the general expertise. So at the board level, you have senior board members that understand these environmental and social challenges, and they advise and monitor the executives on how to bring them in the business. Second, develop the capability to understand which particular environmental and social issues are likely to affect your own business model. Translate that for the organization. Reframe these challenges not only as impediments or inertia, but rather as growth opportunities, right? We know that companies change, and we know that leaders are successful not when they pose something as a threat or as an opportunity, but as both a threat and an opportunity. So you have to allow the organization to culturally transition into this mind frame that says, look, we ought to do this to survive, but at the same time, this might be a growth opportunity given the markets that it opened, right? So, and that means translating this, so corporate executives need to understand that this is a cultural change management process. If you want to embed environmental and social responsibility into the way they do business in order to provoke, essentially, innovation in the business model, innovation in the product or the service, it's a cultural management process. And this is very important because innovation, right, ultimately lies at the core of this adaptation challenge. How else would you adapt to this shifting competitive landscape without doing that? And then there's the more formal structures that you ought to pay attention to. How am I going to translate this strategy into KPIs, into targets, into incentives within the organization? How do am I going to create cross-functional units that work together with the sustainability objectives in mind so that they transition my business into this new landscape? And ultimately, I think for me, speaking with so many executives and board members, I think that if I were to kind of boil it down into as simply as I could tell it, is the following. Business is a very powerful institution, right? We're not talking about charities or philanthropy here. And why is business a powerful institution? What does it do best? Well, it finds a problem, a need, a gap in the market. And what business does is two things. It innovates a solution, broadly defined, and it's able to scale it up efficiently, effectively, and profitably. Profit is very important here because without the profit incentive, right, it's very difficult to scale up. So for for business leaders that want to engage in sustainability, basically need to bring those two capabilities and say, look, the world is packed with environmental and social problems. Could I combine the innovation and scaling up capability of my business to at least address some of them? Because if I do, first of all, that's the million-dollar question. That's how businesses become successful and grow. It's just that in this space, you also get the added benefit of contributing to the resolution to some of the world's biggest challenges.
That's really clear. Excellent advice. Thank you. I was, when I prepared for this conversation, what struck me was how big the topic is. And it took me time to actually to reduce the topic down into a discussion that would take an hour. And just looking through my questions, I think I've only covered two of the six questions that I was originally planning to ask you. So this is clearly an indication that there's a lot to be said here and a lot to be thought that we need to think about. Where can we find out more about your work?
Yes, so you can find out more about my work on the London Business School website. I have a personal website under London Business School in the strategy department. You can find out more about my work on my LinkedIn profile, and I invite all of your listeners, if they're interested in these issues, to do connect with me. I'm quite active on LinkedIn and engaging in these kinds of conversations. We all have a lot to learn from each other. And also, at London Business School, I lead a six-week online course called Sustainability Leadership and Corporate Responsibility. 6 weeks in which we actually go through everything that we discussed today, step by step, and helping senior executives and board members or emerging board members in order to develop this fundamental, foundational, strategic understanding of how to approach sustainability.
Wonderful. This has been a really rewarding, interesting, and actually motivating conversation. So I thank you so much for taking the time to do it.
Thank you very much for having me, Ian. Thoroughly enjoyed this wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow us on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.